what got you to believe that something hidden is going on with the chemtrails?
Well, from about 99 to 2005, I didn't, with the exception of Clifford Carnicom site, didn't find a chemtrail site that dove into the phenomena that a meteorologist wouldn't get up, you know, pushed back from the desk after reading it and laugh. And so I had a real tough time figuring out, you know, kind of what was going on. But I thought, well, with my experience, my access to data and information, I should be able to figure it out. And it wasn't until, I think, August of 2004 that I was in eastern Idaho and saw a 747 painted up green, which was not a color I was, you know, terribly familiar with. And then he laid a trail down. The plane was low and slow, you know, from the northeast corner of the sky to the southwest. And I'm like, oh, my goodness, that's one of them. And so after seeing that first blatant trail laid across the blue sky, I'm like, okay, there's something up. And I thought the only way I'm going to come across the purpose of this is through photography. And so I bought 4 webcams, 2 computers, and some time-lapse software and set them up. But it was 4 months before I caught with these, you know, these cheaper Logitech webcams, you know, a flight pattern that gave the purpose away. And they were simply up there measuring, marking, setting up the geometry to which entrains the jet stream or the flow of air. And, you know, the Weather Service sends up balloons or radio sounds twice a day from about 150 sites across the country to sample the upper atmosphere. Well, my goodness, let's just buy 1,000 planes, outfit them, and then go sample the air directly. You know, so we've got, you know, what the Weather Service is privy to information-wise, and then there's the other that the powers that be have. And there's two completely different worlds. And those trails are up there. So these people know what the atmosphere is doing. They can measure the orgone, and whether we're in, you know, a dead orgone or a live orgone, we're up there measuring the drift of the air, you know, and if they'll apply an electromagnetic solution or a pulse from HARP, they'll run flights out there. They'll run trails across these holes that appear in the sky, and then they get direct measurements of what's going on, and that surveillance then comes back to a computing center as data, and they'll run the models. If what they're doing up off the coast of Alaska is going to dig a deeper low off the California in 3 days' time, and they're happy with it, they'll leave it alone. If they're not happy with what the models are saying the weather's going to do, they'll apply another electromagnetic solution and then grid it up with trails so they can measure what they've just done, the effects of it, and then back into the computer models it goes. So it's this constant watching, surveying, and tweaking. And one thing that they do is they work with what's coming. Absolutely. It's easier, you know, to tweak a storm a little bit in one direction or another, pump up a ridge of high pressure slightly ahead of an inbound trough. That slows it down a little. It may dig it a little bit deeper. But this, there is a playbook. There's got to be a playbook that they're working from. So when we see these disasters with the fires in Russia, and we see the flooding in Pakistan and China and the nation's heartland, you know, this was something that they talked about, you know, weeks to months prior. It's just that simple.
Did you talk about chemtrails when you started looking at them on your TV weathercast in Iowa?
I would mention, because you know, as you understand what they're up there doing, as a forecaster, you know, my goal is to get the most accurate forecast in the hands of my audience. And so I got to the point, especially that last year, of having no problems of saying, you know, that there'll be trails or contrails that likely mush out into a deck of high clouds, you know, fading the sunshine, you know, and that's kind of annoying in December and January when you're hungry for the sunshine or, you know, up in the mountains and want that warmth on your face and it's taken from you. So I would share that with my audience. I'd probably been a little braver now in hindsight. I probably would have said a little bit more, but I really tried to keep my nose clean and not dive into that, you know, per instructions from my general manager.
Well, they came at you in a roundabout way anyway, eventually.
That's usually how it works. But, you know, then that frees you up to talk.
Yeah, absolutely. You
know? So and it opens other doors, other opportunities, and you're always grateful when those show up.
Scott, let's talk about HARP.
Mm.
And if HARP is being used for weather manipulation, and I want to get your full take on that, how can they control it? How do you control something that you bombard into the skies? So, one, is HARP that weather machine that this Russian is talking about? And if it is, how do they control it?
Well, it could be. It could be, but I think it's only a small part of the equation. And I think when you have conspiracies like this, they will let me talk, they will let others talk, because we don't grasp the grandness of the conspiracy. And so we could talk about HARP, but I would speculate that its role in this is probably under 20% of the activities. I'm honestly more concerned about low, mid, and high orbiting, you know, military satellites that have directed energies technologies on them. We know aircraft have a ceiling, and they've got a service ceiling, which is for these commercial planes somewhere, you know, you could push it to the upper 40s to low 50,000 foot range. Then what do we have between that altitude and, say, where the lowest of the satellites would reside, which would be sub 150 miles? There's this great void. And I think that great void is populated by the orbs that we've read, and we have photographs that I've seen. You've probably seen them as well. So I think we have this second technology that is not on anybody's radar, no puns intended, but they can go up there and then they can sit over a location and emit, or, you know, or work in concert with other points, other vibrational sources. And when you get dozens, hundreds, thousands of these, you know, in a specific geometric shape, you can create the geometry to entrain the jet stream. So I think HARP is a small part of it, and just a very small part of it, that there are technologies that very few people have come on your show and talked about. And I think the orbs are one of them that deserve a lot more attention.
Why manipulate the weather?
Because it's fun. I'm serious. Because there is a power associated with that.
You're a meteorologist. Would you love to have one of these machines?
I would, first of all, like to have the understanding of what they're doing. And then I would go from there. But, you know, scientists like to experiment. And if they're truly experimenting, they can't know what they're doing. They can set up the parameters for the experiment. But then once you do it, you have to sit back and observe and see the effect. And I think we've gone through several decades where that has been happening.